This is Phantom Power.
Welcome to another episode of Phantom Power, a podcast that is usually about sound. Today is a bit of an exception. We're doing an episode that a number of you reached out and asked for. My guest today is Jane Von Maren. Jane is senior partner at Avidus Creative Management. She is a former senior vice president at Random House. She's been an editor and publishing executive at Houghton Mifflin and Penguin. And then there's the least of her accomplishments. She's also my new agent. Today, we're going to do a thorough walkthrough of the publishing industry for aspiring nonfiction writers. But before we get to that, a couple of quick notes. Wow, I just feel like we've been cruising through this season with this twice a month schedule. It's already March. It's been a little while since I mentioned what's coming up. In 2 weeks, we will have recent Princeton PhD in history, Benjamin Lindquist. Ben's going to be talking about the history of talking computers. Next up is Marie Thompson of the Open University, who just co-edited a new special issue of the journal Senses and Society. It's a special issue on tinnitus and the aesthetics of tinnitus. So that should be an interesting conversation. I had some folks ask for more tinnitus material, so I'm looking forward to that one. And soon we'll be chopping it up with Neil Verma of Northwestern. We're going to talk about his brand new book on narrative podcasting. I also want to remind you that we have a new feature where you can leave a comment, ask a question, just say whatever you feel. Just go to speakpipe.com/phantompower, press the button and start talking. I'd love to hear from you and maybe you're play your comments or questions on the show. So that's speakpipe.com/phantompower. Okay, on to today's show. At the start of this season, I did an episode called Going Public. And in that episode, I talked about my interest in pivoting to more public writing and public scholarship. And I mentioned finding an agent and learning to navigate the space of non-academic publishing. And I heard from a number of you who said you'd like a deeper dive into that space. And so I asked Jane Von Maren if she'd be willing to come on the show and basically give a primer on trade publishing and how to navigate that world as a first-time author. Jane graciously said yes, and we really get into it today. If you listen to this episode, you will have an action plan by the end of the show. We talk about the structure of the publishing industry, how to take your area of expertise and start thinking about what a public-facing book like might look like, what agents are for, what they look for in authors, what you should look for in them, how to find an agent, how to write a query letter to an agent, and how to craft a book proposal that your agent can shop to publishers. Our patrons will also hear a bonus segment that discusses how an agent shops your proposal to publishers and what happens after that. We also talk money, like what kind of money are we talking about here in this world? And then we provide a number of concrete tips on how to actually write a book for a general audience. All of that plus our What's Good segment where Jane shares something good to read, something good to do, and something good to listen to. To get that full interview with all the bonus content, just go to patreon.com/phantompower. First, let me tell you a little bit about Jane. Something happened in her freshman English class. Jane Von Maren read a poem that changed her life.
A poem called The Idea of Order at Key West by Wallace Stevens. It was about the role of art and culture and how art can be a force of healing and of just making the world right in a way. I became so focused and loved the poem so much that I completely changed my direction. I became an English major and I studied poetry for the rest of my college career, which turned out to be an amazing education for somebody who went into publishing, became an editor, because when you work on poetry, you're learning to look at a work as a whole at the same time that you're looking at it line by line and learning about this way in which the whole and the parts relate, which turned out to be an incredible education for somebody who works with writers and editing and things like that.
The summer after Jane's junior year, she got a job as an editorial assistant at Crown Publishers. And though she did finish up her degree, she really never left the publishing world from that day on.
It was very clear to me within weeks that I loved the job. It was a combination of working with the writers, which was really fun, but also beginning to see two things about publishing. One is that it is a team effort. So many other people are involved, whether it's the production people who help you get a manuscript ready to go to the printer with the copy editing and all of that kind of thing. Then there are the production people who design the pages. What is it going to look like? There are the sales and marketing and publicity people. The other thing that I think was very surprising was that the job is also a sales job, that much of your job as an editor is convincing other people that this book is worth their time, worth their money. Trade publishing in particular is a business first and foremost. And although everybody who goes into it because they want to be able to publish amazing books. But at the end of the day, we all have to make money. The business has to make money. And that's a hard thing to learn about and to figure out.
A hard thing to figure out, but one that Jane excelled at, going up through the ranks in her early years.
When you go into editorial, you start as an editorial assistant, and then there are these steps that you go up. You become an assistant editor, and then an associate editor, and then an editor, senior editor, executive editor, editorial director, editor-in-chief. Those are all the sort of steps. And so I did all of those things pretty much.
While Jane slowly moved up from editorial assistant to senior vice president and publisher at Random House, the industry was changing. Reading habits were changing. Bookstores were consolidating. Ebooks looked like the next big thing. And of course, Amazon rose up and started throwing its weight around. Publishers often responded with belt tightening.
They decided not to have a trade paperback publisher. I lost my job.
After decades of working in the publishing arena and rising to the top of the game, Jane was suddenly on the sidelines.
It was a moment where I really had a chance to stop and think, what do I want to do with my life? I'd gone up this ladder and done really well, but you know, my job at Random House was so much about budgets and schedules and co-op programs and not about what are the books, who are the authors that I want to work with. So that was the moment when I became an agent.
Today, Jane Von Maren is senior partner at Avidus Creative Management, a literary agency that represents everyone from award-winning fiction and nonfiction authors to celebrities. I think what I'd like to do at this point is perhaps lay out a toolkit for aspiring nonfiction authors in our audience with an emphasis on those who have already been writing in the academic world, because a lot of our listeners have been doing that. And then also, to some extent, you know, people who are working in the space of sound or music or media, because that's definitely the interest of most of our listeners. So I thought maybe we could start off with the lay of the land in the publishing industry, and then we could move on to more the writing side of things, crafting a proposal and a manuscript.
Right.
So let's talk about presses. You know, there are academic presses, there are trade presses. Maybe there are presses that are somewhere in between. Could you talk a little bit about that situation?
So as you point out, there are academic presses and there are trade presses. I think the major difference between the two are, one, that an academic press is usually most focused on publishing work that contributes to an academic discipline. That they are, that the work be new, that the work be, you know, and again, an addition to what is already out there. Some academic presses also have some financial imperatives and others do not. So that part of it is less is usually less important in terms of making acquisitions decisions about why they're acquiring something. And then there are academic presses that also don't pay in advance. They only pay royalties. So that can also be different. Many academic presses also don't have a huge, what we would call, bookstore or trade distribution. You wouldn't find a lot of those books necessarily in Barnes & Noble, for example. Whereas a trade press is really about books that are for a general audience that are going to be sold through regular retail bookstores, whether it's Barnes & Noble or Amazon or your local independent bookstore. They also sell books through what is called the mass merch channel, which are Target, Costco, places like that, the airport stores. Not every book goes through those channels, but some of them do. And there are then even some books that will be sold, let's say, in Urban Outfitters or places like that, which are more gifty type of things. Now, the sort of middle, the sort of press that's in between the academic press and the trade press, I think does exist, and it really has to do with editorial focus. They're still trade presses. And so the one that comes to mind most readily is Basic Books. And Basic Books is part of the Hachette Book Group, which is a big one of the big five publishers. And yet most of their authors are academics, and they are looking for books that really do contribute to the conversation. And their hope is to have those books be important in the academic setting, but also be important in the trade, in, you know, among general readers. They're not necessarily looking to have a number one bestseller all the time, but they are looking to have books that are serious and rigorous and that add to the conversation.
Would Verso be another example of a press that's kind of respected by academics but also read by non-academics?
Yes, although I think they also have a, I think of their focus as being as much having books that have real rigor and things like that, but they also have a sort of point of view about the kinds of books that they publish, the same as Bold Type books, right? Bold Type, which is used to be Nation books, that sort of somewhat leftist, somewhat political, that kind of thing.
You know, I guess it was almost a year ago now, actually. I went to a writer's workshop at the Jackman Institute for the Humanities at the University of Toronto. And it was this really amazing workshop where a bunch of academics who had published academic books but were now thinking about writing for the public were assembled. It was led by Gretchen Baca and Evelyn Jago. And I learned a ton, made some really great friends. People were working on really interesting stuff. But I remember when the opening of that workshop, they were kind of talking about the differences between academic presses and trade presses. And they said, most of you in this room are going to be tempted and are going to want to write a crossover book that appeals to both academics and non-academics, because you want to reach a wider audience, but you're not ready to let go of that academic audience and the respect that they, you know, would have for your work. And then they warned, they're like, this is extremely difficult to do, and that you're probably going to wind up with a book that non-academics can't read and academics don't respect. So, and they're basically saying, like, pick a lane, you know? And I was comfortable with that. I really wanted to write for a general audience, but I wonder your opinion. First of all, do you agree with that dichotomy?
Yes, I do. I think that there are times when academic writers feel that they need the credibility or the sort of to be respected by their academic peers in an academic way. And that often means a book that is not accessible to most, you know, general readers. And so you do kind of have to pick a lane. It is pretty difficult. And I think that, you know, one of the things that is different about a trade book is that you are writing for a general reader and you have to write things that will appeal to them in one way or another, which does not mean that you have to not have rigor or high standards or have complexity. It just means you have to speak and write in language that is free of jargon, that is accessible to a wider group of people. And I think that for some people, it's very hard leaving behind the sort of structure that you get from certain kinds of academic language and ways of putting together arguments that are very natural and comfortable in an academic setting, whether it's a paper or an academic book, that in a trade book just aren't going to work.
You know, I had sort of a commercial writing background before I went to grad school. Mm-hmm. And there was a kind of writing that I learned to do in grad school, which is extremely defensive, right? Like you're couching every claim saying, well, of course, there are these three exceptions, of course. Folks, I know, you know, like you're just waiting for people to poke holes in your argument. Mm-hmm, and it makes a lot of sense as an academic to do that, but it's extremely tedious for a non-academic to have to read that. Like, I think for a general audience person, like they'll see a PhD behind your name and they're probably like, okay, I believe you know what you're talking about. Just tell me what you want to say, right? Like, mm-hmm. and make it interesting, like maybe put it in a story rather than right. some kind of, you know, terse academic language.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's right. I think readers who come to a general trade book aren't looking to poke holes in it, which is not to say that some people don't. You know, some people will say, oh, well, I don't believe this, or I take issue with this, but that's not the agenda. Whereas I think sometimes among academics, when you're reading something, you're reading it to sort of see how does it fit into what you know about this subject, or how does it relate to the work that you're doing? And so there's probably a lot more sort of compare and contrast that's going on simply as you're reading something. I'm intuiting that. I may be wrong about that, but it seems to make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's a gamble. You're pivoting to a different audience, and your mm-hmm. former audience is going to look at that and say, hey, what about us? Are you no longer a serious part of our community? Like that's a risk. That's even a bit of a loss. And mm-hmm. that's probably not for most academics. Most of us probably aren't going to want to do that, which is fine. But mm-hmm. I think that sense that, oh, well, I can have it both ways is just going to be a huge temptation because of that.
Right. You know. So I guess I have a question about that, which is by writing a book for a general audience, it doesn't seem as if you necessarily need to sort of exile yourself from an academic world. It's just this particular work is going to be for a general audience. You could presumably still be writing for an academic audience, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I shouldn't overstate the decision, but I think because our time is so limited, you know, there's so many other things that are on our plate besides just doing our research. You are right. Kind of, if you're committing to a whole book, that's probably a year or two that right. you're just not going to really be able to devote to your usual mode of right. scholarship.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say you're a person who has decided, oh, I do want to make this pivot and I'm going to be looking at the trade press world. Are there certain categories of books that tend to do better than others that are maybe more legible to non-experts or have a more of a mm-hmm. built-in audience? That a sort of media or, you know, whatever music writer might gravitate towards?
That's a really interesting question and a hard one to answer because it changes. I think there'll be certain periods of time when there are lots of books that are in sort of one vein, and then people then pivot because it's been done. So let's say lots and lots of sort of memoir type of books, and then people don't want the personal voice. They want something that's more grounded in research, and then they think, oh, we want something else. So I think it's hard to answer. In terms of sort of music and media, I think that there have always been lots of books about music, and everything from musicians writing about their own work or their own lives to people writing about music, whether somebody like Ann Powers, the music critic who's done a lot of writing about music and things like that, to even the business of music and things like that. Media is also, people do write about it a lot. Sometimes it's sort of more in a business perspective, the sort of the rise of a particular kind of media. Then there's obviously critiques of it. I think right now lots of people are writing about AI, which is not quite media, but obviously impacts all of that. So again, these things are cyclical. It depends what is sort of in the air and the zeitgeist, what are people drawn to and interested in. But I think one of the things about writers and about people who are experts is that they have an expertise. And the trick, in a way, for a trade publisher is to give an editor the sense of why this expertise, why this book matters. Why, you know, what is it adding to the conversation that's going on right now? Why is what you have to say really important? And why are you the person to bring this part of the conversation forward? And making that feel urgent and important in the moment, the moment that we're in, is very compelling to an editor.
Yeah, I'm thinking about certain kinds of books that maybe have a little bit of a built-in audience. So like you talked about music, like a music book could be sold at a record store as well as a bookstore, especially if it's sort of pitched towards, you know, a particular genre or audience or, or artist. Regional books. So I was just down in New Orleans, and I went to, you know, one of the bookstores I like down there, and there's just a New Orleans section, like right when you walk in, and that's what I was looking for. Right. And so I think those kinds of things, like if you're thinking, you could maybe think about like, how could my research expertise sort of, could I frame it in such a way that it makes sense in one of those spaces, perhaps?
Absolutely. I think it really also depends on what your research expertise is. So for example, if, you know, does it make sense to sort of focus in on a particular place? There's a strength to that. And so if you have a book that is really going to highlight, say, something that happened in New Orleans, and let's say it's music, you have an area from which to grow, right? New Orleans is a great place to launch because it's connected, but you also, it's also recognized that, you know, New Orleans is a place where certain kinds of music comes from. So the fact that it's also about music gives you that broader, more national audience. You don't want something that is so narrow in scope that it feels as if only New Orleans is going to be interested in it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose another possibility, and again, this is like gets into that trying to thread the needle, I suppose, between academic and non-academic, but is people who are coming from an academic background, could they be thinking about, okay, this is a trade press book, it's written for a general audience, but it could also be useful in an intro class on X.
Yes.
Is that something that people might want to consider?
Absolutely. I think that is very, very wise to think about, especially for somebody who's an academic. And there are publishers who are particularly adept at making sure that their books are seen by university professors, college professors. Norton is one of them, obviously, since they have a huge textbook arm themselves. Penguin Random House has long had a very strong academic reach into both high schools and the college arena. In fact, when I was at Penguin, they really literally had two sales reps who would travel the country talking to professors about Penguin books. They weren't trying to sell them. They were just, here, we have this book. Would you be interested? And we also actually got great ideas for books from their reports. It was incredible. They would say, I was talking about to so-and-so, and there was really a need for a book about X. And somebody would think, oh, that's interesting. Let me see what I can do. So I'm not sure that they have those reps anymore, but it was really fun. And most of the biggest publishers, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Macmillan, Hachette, and Penguin Random House, do have some kind of marketing that is focused on schools and universities.
Okay. So let's say at this point you've decided you're doing this trade press lane.
Yeah.
You've thought about, you know, what general niche you might want to be going for. What do you do next?
Right. So I think two things have to happen. One is you have to have some sense of what the book is or what you want to write about. Because when you approach an agent, you're going to want to approach them with something in mind. And that usually happens in the form of a query letter. So you're writing to somebody and saying, you know, I'm Mac Haygood. I work here. This is my specialization. I want to write a book about X. Sort of being able to give a sense of what that book is in a few sentences that are very compelling, and a sense of, you know, what kind of exposure you've had to a trade marketplace before, whether it's being interviewed by the Washington Post or having your work written about in some other place, or you've written a bunch of pieces that have appeared in academic journals. Those are also useful. What you're trying to give is a sense of who you are in the world. And then you can send that off. And most of those query letters are done by email. And one of the questions I often get is, well, how do I know who to send to? Mm-hmm. And that's a really good question, because you do want to send to somebody who is going to be open to the kind of work that you're doing. And one of the things that I always tell people to do is go and look at the acknowledgments in books that are similar to the kind of book you think you want to write. It doesn't have to be exactly in your subject area, but sort of have the kind of seriousness that whatever, how general market is it versus a little bit more academic, what the writing level is and things like that. Go and look at the acknowledgments and see who's there. That's one way of figuring it out. Another way is there is a organization called Publishers Marketplace, which is, some of it is free, some of it you have to subscribe to, but you put publishersmarketplace.com and you will get to it. And it has all this incredible information about who buys what kind of books, what agent's email address is. Not everybody's email addresses are on there, but a lot are. And so it can give you, it's a great way of getting information and then how to figure out how to get in touch with people. And those are really, really good ways. Another way is to talk to people you know. Do you know people who have been published in the trade area? Do they have agents? Kind of ask people, and you can get connections that way. I mean, the way that you and I met is pretty unusual. You should tell that story, Matt.
Basically, the very short story is I was being interviewed by a reporter from the Washington Post. And I just mentioned that I was thinking of writing a trade press book. And she's like, you should meet my agent. And yeah, I mean, I don't know how common that is, but I guess. The idea, though, is that it's these social connections that you could think about. Who do I know who is publishing now? And could I approach them and ask them about?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, and in the, in our case, the reporter who was interviewing you wrote to me and said, I just interviewed the most amazing guy. He wants to do a trade book. Do you want to be introduced? And so, and I said, yes. So, and the truth is that kind of referral happens a lot. Huh. I get a lot of clients from people I've published or people I represent who say, oh, I know somebody who's interested in doing this. And would you like to meet them? Which is great. And then there are also people that I represent who I reach out to myself. I have read something where they're quoted or they've written a piece that I found really interesting, and then I reach out to them. So that happens too, particularly early on in your agenting career when you don't have a lot of, you know, there aren't tons of people referring things to you. And so it's really fun.
Yeah. I feel like I should credit the person who introduced it is Stacy. Yeah. Stacy Colino.
No.
And she is actually someone that you work with, right?
She's my client.
Sold a couple of books for her. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. So she, yes. And Stacy is somebody who, often works with experts and helps them write their books. So the first book that we worked on together was a book that she wrote with Shauna Swan, who is a very world famous epidemiologist, and she's done a lot of work about falling sperm counts and what that means for men and also humankind. So we did that book, and so she's done a lot of different things, and she's just an incredible science and health and wellness reporter and has been great to work with. So, and has very good instincts also for who would make good writers.
I can also say that I did pursue the Publisher's Marketplace, which is a really fascinating like wormhole that you can lose, you know, weeks in if you allow yourself to. It's a little overwhelming, the amount of information that's out there, but like, just like, you know, searching for your favorite nonfiction authors and finding out who their agents are. And there's even this really very strange coded language about how much money each project sold for, allegedly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how much to believe these things that you see in Publisher's Marketplace, but somebody has to disclose these numbers. I don't know who's disclosing them, if it's the agent or the author or... Probably right. Not the publisher, right?
So it really depends. Many people try to have those announcements of a book deal come out without any kind of disclosure of how much money is involved. From my perspective as an agent, I think it's nobody's business. It's the author's business, and you know, mm-hmm. they don't necessarily need to know how much a book sold. Other people don't need to know. And although there are times when a publisher or an agent will want to sort of indicate that it sold for a lot of money, because one of the ways in which Publisher's Marketplace is used is that foreign publishers will look at what has sold. Movie and TV people look at it. So there are times when you're trying to signal the rest of the marketplace or other parts of the marketplace by what you say in the sales announcement. So that can be why it's there. And most people, they're accurate, but the ranges, the good sale versus the, I rarely put in the numbers. So, or the amount,
The terminology is something like a nice deal, a very nice deal. It's really funny.
Right. Exactly.
And those signify exactly. like
yes, could amounts differ of by money. Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. It's really crazy.
Exactly. It is. And then once you send out that query letter, so what is the next step? So hopefully you get a response. And one of the things that is probably really hard is that a lot of times you don't. I, as an agent, do try and respond, but sometimes it's just, you know, you get so many emails a day and you can't necessarily respond. So I don't, sure. I sometimes don't. I try to, but I sometimes don't. And then if you do get a, you know, oh, I'm interested in this, send me what you have. So with nonfiction, you're selling your book most often using a proposal. And that process, that proposal process is, and creating it is sort of an art form because it's a document that serves a bunch of different purposes. It is both a sales document and an editorial document and a kind of mission statement. And getting all of the elements of it put together is tricky. But you should have something that is a little bit longer than your query letter to be able to send to show what the writing is like and what you're thinking about for the book. And so, and if you don't, you know, there are agents who will work with you from the ground up, but often they'll want you to have something.
So in my case, I had the application that I wrote for the National Endowment for the Humanities Public Scholar Grant, and I just sort of took off some of the more academic edges off of that and basically had that available so that when you asked me, you said you were interested in seeing more, I think I sent you some version of that thing, which is sort of gave you a pretty good sense of it. And I mean, maybe we should clarify your, I mean, the relationship between an agent and an author, it certainly one hopes will be an ongoing relationship that could span numerous books. But in the beginning, you're really selling one particular project, right? So this is really about, I'm pitching this particular book.
Right.
Does this feel like something that you could sell?
Mm-hmm.
And, and how do you as an agent, because, you know, you work on commission, so you need to be placing good bets on books that are going to reward your time financially. Mm-hmm. How do you decide who you're going to work with? What project looks good to you based on these query letters or other ways that you meet authors?
That's a great question. I think part of what makes being an agent an amazing job is that you are able to work on anything you want. So part of it is I read something and I think, oh, this is so interesting. This is so exciting. I really like the sound of this. And first and foremost is, am I interested? Partly because the time that you're going to put in over, you know, over the next however many months, possibly years, it's significant. And so you have to feel enough excitement and interest to want to do that. And then I think there's also a sense of knowing how publishers think and thinking about how does this particular idea seem in terms of what people are looking for, what people are interested in, what's going on in the world at the moment. Are there books like it that I can think of? Are there, when I'm reading it, do I think, oh, so-and-so editor is going to love this? Do I immediately start thinking about who are the editors who are going to be potential buyers of the book? So it's things like that. Have I done something in this space before? There are certain, I think each one of us as agents develop areas that we're interested in, and you kind of end up having authors who kind of fit into sort of groups. You know, they're not doing the exact same things, but that you can see how they're connected. So for example, when we first spoke, I think I spoke to you about this book called Golden, which is about the power of silence, right? Which is this related, but not exactly what you're doing. But it was in a world that seemed similar. I could see how the dots connected. And it also was something really interesting to me. So
that's a book by Justin Zorn and Lee Mars. And that's one that you successfully sold.
Yeah. 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 We had an auction for it and it went really well. Yeah. It was published by Harper at HarperCollins. Yep.
That's great. I've dipped into it a little bit, but I've kind of held back from actually reading it because I didn't want to get too influenced by it.
No, that's fine. That's fine. No, and it's funny because that, you know, then you read the book and you think, and particularly me as somebody who was an editor for many years, there's sort of choices that you think, oh, would I have done that? Or might I have wanted them to do slightly different things with, you know, as they were developing the book, you know, once it was sold, some things that changed from the proposal and things like that, which happens. And that's appropriate because ultimately once the proposal is done and it, you know, and you're working with an editor, then it is the editor who needs to drive that, the editorial process.
Yeah, yeah. And I definitely want to talk about that more a little bit later. But I did notice in the book that they seem to make a move that is a little different from what we usually do in the academic world, but seems to be a very common move in nonfiction where they kind of tell the story of how they got interested in this subject matter and like how it sort of captured them, that they probably almost set up like a little mini crisis in the introduction. And then they realized that they were able to sort of transcend this problem through embracing silence, which sort of clarifies what the topic of the book is about, but also kind of sets up the stakes for it and gives a narrative entryway for the reader. Like, oh, this is interesting. Oh, I see how they got into this. That seems to be a kind of a strategy now that, you know, I noticed certain strategies that authors use in trade press books, and that seems to be one of them.
Yes, I think that's right. I think it's a way in which authors can lay out what the book is about, what they're exploring, and doing it in a way that the reader can identify with.
Yeah.
So that I may be an expert, but I'm a human being like you, and I'm dealing with the same issues out in the world that you are.
So yeah, it's a different strategy. But maybe we can get back into talking about your process of thinking about, oh, who's an author that I want to work with. Right. When I was sort of doing research online, I found this sort of rather intimidating and for some reason to me depressing word kept popping up, which was platform. That an author needs to have a platform. Can you talk a little bit about that, what that is, and does that factor into your considerations as well?
Platform is a word that publishers and agents talk about all the time. And what it means is, what are the things that you as an author bring with you that will help you get the word out there about the book, connect to your audience, and kind of help the publisher publish the book in a way so that the book will sell more copies? And it ranges wildly. So it can be the fact that you have been interviewed by various journalists, and therefore you have a connection, you have a relationship with some of these journalists, and when your book is published, you'll be able to reach out to them and say, hey, I've just published this book, I'd love you to, you know, well, I'm going to have my publisher send you a copy, I'd love it if you, you know, took a look, if you want to write about it, that would be great, or whatever. It may be that you're out there doing lectures all the time, and so you have that kind of audience, and if you're doing lots of lecturing and talks, you can sell books, perhaps. It may be that you have a podcast, and you know the podcast will help you to get the word out about the book. All of these things are ways in which you as an author bring this platform, this ability to say, I'm not just Jane Von Maren, I'm Jane Von Maren, who is also well known by these journalists, and I have connections with them, and so they'll help get the word out. And so who do you know? What are the things that you have access to that can help you get the word out about the book so that it will sell more copies? And it's a variety of things. You, for example, you're an academic. Is your institution interested in helping get the word out? Is, you know, there's all kinds of things. So do I think about it? Yes, I do. And I think about it because publishers think about it. There's nothing worse than having somebody say to you, well, this is so interesting, but this person has no platform. Mm-hmm. And the platform question has become more and more important because there are fewer book reviews. There are fewer physical bookstores that people are going into to just see books. it's a lot harder to make people aware of books than it used to be. So the fact that you have, as an author, the ability to reach out to an audience who is going to be interested in what you're writing about, that is very meaningful to a publisher because it helps them be able to do more.
Well, I think the large variety of things that you put on the table there and the fact that none of them were social media, I think makes it much less depressing to me when I said that. because I have seen, you know, some, and this is probably varies by genre of book, but I mm-hmm. have certainly seen people who seem to equate platform with how many followers do you have on Instagram?
Right.
And for me, that's very few. So
right. So I will say that social media is one way to have a platform. Mm-hmm. And I will give credit to publishers for having become more sophisticated about the way that they look at social media, because it's not just how many followers you have, but are they engaged? You know, you could have a million followers, but if none of them are actually engaging with you or only a small percentage, it doesn't yeah. really matter, right? It's not meaningful. So I think that's definitely something that has changed. There's also the fact that maybe you don't have a huge social media platform, but you know five people who do, who are huge mm. supporters of your work and who have very engaged followings. That can be as meaningful as anything else. So are lots of things, you know. And I think the other thing that publishers will tell you is that if social media is not your thing, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, then you shouldn't, because authenticity is really important. Being able to engage is really important. And if you don't want to do that, then you're not really going to be able to build a following there and you're just wasting your time. So there are probably kinds of, you know, for example, if you're, you know, doing cookbooks or you're doing lifestyle kind of stuff, you probably do need to be on Instagram and connecting with people, because that people are looking at those pictures and all of that kind of stuff. But
yeah.
But for many people, social media per se is not the only way to have a platform.
I think that's so helpful, especially that piece about authenticity with social media. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think the wasting time just trying to get your numbers up, I think that comes across. And I also think there's just some strange, like, voodoo or mojo that with social media that I don't have. It's just not a space where I spend much time. I love having mm-hmm. conversations, like podcasting for me. It's a one-on-one thing. It feels intimate. I learn so much from doing it. Like, that is something I can easily spend my time on. Right. Engaging on social media, it just feels like a chore to me. And I'm mm-hmm. so I'm glad to hear there are other options. But for some of our listeners, you know, they're really great on social media. So I guess the lesson here is play to your strengths and what feels right, what comes naturally.
Yes, I think that's exactly right.
We've talked a lot about the agent side of the equation, what the agent is looking for in the author. What should the author be looking for in an agent?
That's a great question. So I think one thing about the author-agent relationship is that, ideally, as you pointed out, it lasts for many books. So you're hopefully signing on for a long-term relationship. And so you want to feel, not only does this person understand your work, but does this person understand what I want from this? Not everybody is necessarily looking to get the most amount of money for a book, or there are reasons that having a book come out at a certain time is really important. You want an agent who is going to understand those things and be able to work with you on those things. It's not that an agent is necessarily going to be able to do everything that you want, but you want them to at least be on the same page and everybody working towards the same thing. So whether it's, I had a client who was up for tenure, so it was really important that we sold his book. Mm-hmm. Luckily, we did that. But it's so for his tenure decision, it was really important that he have this book under contract. And so that was great. I had, you know, that can be one thing.
I don't think I mentioned to you, but I'm kind of in that situation too. Except for full,
okay.
It's for full professor. So yeah, I got to get this proposal done.
Done. Okay. Okay. There we go. So, but there are things like that. And then, you know, and sometimes being published by a particular publisher might be really important to you. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe that means that you accept less money than somebody else because you really want to be with a particular publisher or a particular editor. An agent
is
also.
I think you asked me that question if there was a particular, and I felt pretty undistinguished in that I had no preference at all. I was like,
most people
that pays the most money.
most people don't. I will tell you that most people don't have a preference. So you are not alone.
Okay.
And the other thing is that you want somebody that you feel that you can really talk with and be, you know, and be able to be very transparent. You're an agent is an advisor. So you want somebody who's going to be able to not only say, oh, this is how we can do what you want to do, but also somebody who'll say, you know, I understand why you want to do that, but actually it's not the right move for you. And here's why. Mm. And things like that. You want somebody who's an advocate, but who's also willing and able to be clear about why something makes sense or doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So I think there's that. And I think having somebody who's had experience inside a publishing company is really helpful. It's not
right.
necessary, but I certainly find I'm surprised by some things that I know that even colleagues who have been agents as long as I've been in publishing, so for decades, things that about the workings in-house that they don't know that I would have thought they would have known. So
yeah. Working with you, I mean, seemed like such a no-brainer in a sense because you had all of this experience and, you know, I just felt like we had really good rapport and I felt comfortable mm-hmm. talking to you. I could understand what you were saying, all those kinds mm-hmm. of things. You know, I spoke to some other agents and mm-hmm. there were differing experiences there. Everyone had different strengths and weaknesses. I just wonder, like, for people who are maybe weighing, like maybe somebody who's has less experience than you, but the rapport is really good. Or conversely, somebody who has tons of experience, has sold tons of books, but maybe that rapport isn't there as much, right? Like, I feel like with you, there was a sweet spot where the middle of the Venn diagram was there, but I think for maybe a mm-hmm. lot of people, there might be a kind of choice that if they're lucky enough to have a couple of agents interested, they might need to choose between those two scenarios. Do you have any thoughts about that?
So I think the one thing that I would say is you want to have a clear sense of how the agent likes to work. And so that you get a sense of, is this somebody I'm going to be able to get in touch with and have them respond to me? Is this somebody who I can ask all my, you know, seemingly dumb questions, but there are no dumb questions, but, you know, that was going to have the time and the patience to do that? Is this somebody who understands what my book is or what I'm trying to do? So I think it's that kind of thing. I think somebody who's younger and hungrier sometimes can be the right choice because they're younger and hungrier and they have more, you know, they have fewer clients. They're excited about moving forward and that can be a great option. Somebody who's been at it a long time and who does tons and tons of deals can also be great. I think that person who's done tons and tons of deals and maybe there's not so much rapport, what you want to make sure in that case is that they're going to give you enough time, that they're going to be willing to, because I think that sometimes happens, that they're the senior person and, you know, of course they can sell your book, but you're not necessarily going to get the best sort of advising and the best attention from somebody like that.
Yeah. And I would reinforce that just based on my experience with friends who have had either prominent literary agents or prominent editors who wound up feeling kind of like the small fish in the big pond and didn't maybe get the attention either to help them craft the book into what they really felt like it could have been, or perhaps didn't get the strong marketing push from the publisher, even though they landed with a Dream Press.
Yeah, I think all of those things are true. When it comes to the publisher itself, a lot of the things that happen in the sort of marketing and publicity process and selling process are partly up to the editor and then partly completely out of control of the editor. And so it's a tricky balance. And in fact, this is a place where your agent can be helpful, both in terms of setting up realistic expectations and also being able to ask the questions, facilitate the conversation so that you can get more of what is possible. You know, asking for a full page ad in the New York Times is probably not possible. And so let's not go
Come
there.
Come on, but I thought that's what we were doing for my book.
But there are other things that are possible. And so let's focus on those things, right? So,
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so let's wrap up this piece about the industry and the agent and what happens with two last questions, which are, what exactly is the proposal that you and the agent work on together? And then I want to know about, after you've finished this proposal, what are you going to do with it?
Yeah. What happens? Okay. So the proposal itself is, as I said, it's this weird document that is sales pitch, editorial sort of exemplar, and a kind of mission statement. And I think I may have even described it to you like this when we first spoke. I often compare it to a set of blueprints for a house. And that first page, which is the overview, is that pretty picture of the outside of the house. And it's kind of the, you know, what is this book? Why am I writing it? Why now? Who's it for? And a little bit about what the structure of the book is. And then as you, you know, as you lift the pages, you get inside and you see the plumbing, which might be about the author. And then there's the electrical that might be the comps and the audience and, you know, and some other thing that's the marketing and publicity plan. And then you have sample material and chapter summaries, which help the editor see how this big idea and sort of vision of the book that you've laid out in the overview is going to actually be realized in the course of the book. And it's a balance between what's actually going to be in it, sample writing, and enough kind of promise of what. You don't want to put everything into the proposal. That's one of the weird things. And chapter summaries is often a misnomer, because you don't want to summarize everything. You want to sort of give a sense of here's what it's going to be. And I'm also going to talk about this, this, and this, so that you don't want an editor to finish reading a proposal and think, oh, that was great. Thank you. You know, on to the next. You want them to think, oh my God, that was so interesting. I need to know more. So it's this interesting balance.
Yeah. So some things that jump out for me there, first of all, I mean, in contrast to a fiction book, you're not presenting the entire manuscript, right? Like this proposal is sort of like you said, the blueprint that is going to show what you're going to do in the book. So I think one thing that I've noticed that academics will tend to think is like, oh, I'm going to write this book and then I'm going to find an agent and get this book published. Like, that's a little bit putting the cart before the horse, right? Because part of what you're working with an agent for is for their expertise on what the market is interested in and then how to pitch that. And you might wind up writing a very different book from the one that you just wrote on your own, because it has a scholarly import, because you're kind of not selling just scholarly import, right? Like, as you said a moment ago, there has to be a why now, a who cares, sort of dimension mm-hmm. that you need to spell out in that proposal.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. And the other thing is that a proposal is potential, right? It's if you write the whole thing, then an editor can say, oh, okay, I don't think this works. And mm-hmm. whereas in a proposal, there's still the opportunity to say, well, I'm not sure that this table of contents is in the right order, but it's only a table of contents, right? You can change it. And so it's all potential. And which is not to say that, you know, when you have a manuscript that the editor won't edit it, but if you're selling it based on a manuscript, it's often more difficult. And, you know, for example, in fiction, where you do have to sell on a full manuscript, at least for your first book, you often get people who will pass, or they'll say, you know, if you revise it, I will look again. Here are my thoughts, but I'd be happy to look at it again. And so you have to go and revise it rather than buying the book and working with the author to edit it, to make those revisions. So a proposal is it's a really hard thing to do because you are juggling all of these different sort of focuses and things that you have to do with a proposal, but mm-hmm. at least you're not writing the whole book. And once you have a proposal, you also have a terrific map for what you are going to do. So even if you end up changing some things, you still have something very strong to work from.
Yeah. And as someone who is working on the proposal right now, it's been really interesting to me how similar it is to just straight up writing, right? I mean, I'm mm-hmm. coming up with the structure in advance in this way. I mean, it's very clarifying. It's a learning curve for me and it's a challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a part of me that's like, oh, come on, I just want to get to writing the book. But but on the other hand, it's like, well, this is going to make writing the book so much easier because if someone buys this and signs on to it, and it's like you said, I've got that blueprint. So you've got this proposal, and then there are also sample chapters. Or a sample chapter is a. I've seen people mm-hmm. say two chapters. I've seen people say one chapter. Like, where do you come down on that?
So I think nowadays people want to be able to see what the book is without having to read 100 pages, right? So if you can keep it to 60 or 75 pages, you're in a great shape. If it's more, it's fine, but.
That's including the proposal and the sample chapter?
Yeah. So uh-huh. If it's more, it's fine, particularly if it's really fun to read the way yours is. And so I think one chapter is fine. There are some proposals that I have sold that do not have any sample chapters, but each of the sort of chapter summaries really feel like they begin with a kind of narrative that is kind of might be in the book, and then you get to the end of it, and then there's more of the kind of, in this chapter, I'll do blah, 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 blah. And so it really it depends on how good a writer you are, you know, and how effective you can be. But having
that's
a
really
sample
cool.
chapter is...
Mm-hmm. I didn't even know that was a possibility. That's the way I've been trying to write my sample my chapter descriptions. So
that's great.
Maybe I can get out of writing a sample chapter.
Yeah, we'll see. Absolutely. Okay. We will see. So that's good. So I think usually nowadays one sample chapter is fine. Particularly because the overview should also be in the should kind of be the voice that you'll be using in the book. And so that also, you know, serves as a kind of, it's also a kind of sample. Sample of your writing there too.
So you're writing the proposal the way you're going to write the book, like if it...
To a certain extent. Although there are places where you're going to be very explicit and, you know, write in a way, you know, in this book I will, which obviously in the book you would never do. So, that's why it's a weird document because you do both of those things.
So we've got the proposal. Now you've got the proposal, you're satisfied with it, you've given a lot of feedback and the authors responded mm-hmm. and now it's a nice polished document. Mm-hmm. What do you do with this thing?
Right. Okay. So
hi there. Sorry to interrupt. If you're hearing my voice, it means you're in the public feed, and this is the end of the show. If you want to hear the rest of my discussion with Jane, switch on over to our Patreon feed. Just go to patreon.com/phantompower. It's very quick and easy. You can sign on for as little as $3 a month. It helps a lot. And we're going to talk about some really cool stuff. She's going to get into the money. Like, what kind of money is in the trade press world? Are we talking about, I can take a little bit of a vacation this year? Or is it more like, maybe I can buy a new house kind of money? And we do provide a bunch of concrete tips on writing for a general audience. Some really practical stuff that I think has been helping me a lot as I learn this craft. All of that in our What's Good segment. To get the full thing, go to patreon.com/phantompower. And that's it for this episode of Phantom Power. Thanks so much for joining me. Today's show was edited by Niso Sasha and myself. Our web and transcript person is Caitlin Fan. And our SEO and social media content person is Devin Ankeny. Today's music was by yours truly. And I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye.